I'm Greg Johnson. I want you to ask me anything. I have a number of questions here. The first question I have is from my friend and longtime listener, Sutton. Sutton wonders what my thoughts are on, quote unquote, the Fuentes drama. Well, I wrote to Trav LeBlanc today and I said, Trav, would you like to write up a comprehensive report on the latest Fuentes drama? I haven't heard back from him yet, but he's really the guy. He's the guy who can report on internet drama. He can do exhaustive research, endlessly long streams, and always come away with a lesson that's bigger than just gossip column, he said, she said stuff. So I'm hoping Trav will come back and report on the latest Fuentes drama. I did something today that I almost never do. I listened to this Kino Casino stream that is more than 5 hours long. I listened to more than 2 hours of the stream. I listened to the juicy stuff starting around 40 minutes in, and I bustled around and did chores and stuff like that because I just find that being a passive consumer of information, of noise, of voices like that is just too much for me. I put it on 1.25 speed. That helped. But it was pretty riveting nonetheless. It was unusually riveting drama because what's happened is basically this, and I've been hearing rumblings of this for some time, that there is going to be a great explosion in the world of Nick Fuentes, and the world of Nick Fuentes is blowing up. So anyway, his friend Jaden, who used to be with the Turning Point USA in his Midwestern school, I think in Kansas, and then became involved with the Groyper movement, he was sort of Nick's friend, Nick's good friend. Although Nick seems to have very weird friendships because they were supposedly really good friends. They lived in the same town. He actually lived in a building owned by Nick and would see him once a month, maybe. And this guy had a lot of inside knowledge of how Fuentes behaves. Another fellow named Simon, who seems to be tirelessly idealistic, hardworking movement guy who was just miserably exploited and abused by Fuentes for years, also spoke. And basically, they just laid out the pattern of his behavior, that he is this narcissistic, manipulative, sociopathic drama queen who basically sows discord amongst the people around him, so they're all suspicious and fighting amongst each other, and who engages in threats of doxing, threatens to dox people to the federal government or to Antifa, to the public, to people who wish to harm them if they go against Nick Fuentes. So if you get involved with Fuentes, you better hope that he doesn't have a mercurial turn against you because he might try and destroy your life. That's the message that came out. Came out that he's extremely manipulative and extremely vindictive. And he really crosses what I think is the great line, which is doxing. There's another line, which is informing to the federal government or the state government for that matter, the police, but especially the feds. He seems to be have skirted that line, at least threatened to. And so you can't really build a dissident movement with somebody who's such a narcissistic egomaniac that just based on his personal whims, he will resort to doxing people, including donors. You can't expect a movement to attract quality people if you have people like that in it. And so I think it's really time to just pull the shroud up over Nick Fuentes' face and bury him. And I hope the people who are involved in his movement bail out fast. I think they should all head out quickly. He can't dox you all, right? He can't get you all. And maybe they should start ratting on him. And his friends revealed some pretty shocking things. For instance, Nick has been fundraising and dining out and pretending to be a big victim, about $500,000 that was seized by the government. Apparently, that money has been given back and was given back last year sometime. But he continued to dine out on that, to fundraise on it, to play the victim on that for a very long time. So there's something very, very rotten in the America First movement. And I expect that a whole bunch more of this dirt and drama is going to come out. And frankly, it's good because the sooner we're rid of this guy, the better. I've always had a very strongly negative impression of his character, and I was pretty much betting that given just the type of person he is abusive to the people around him, and eventually the people around him are going to get tired of being abused, and they're going to pull the plug on his operation. And that does seem to be happening now. So anyway, those are my thoughts. It's actually pretty compelling viewing, and I really hope Trav comes back to Countercurrents and writes it all up, because he's the guy. He's definitely the guy. Komi Kobayashi, the squeaky Zoomer voices. Doxing donors, unforgivable. That's Reed Johnson. Talk about self-destructive, searching for cummies with a black light. That was my favorite story. Apparently, once Jaden moved out, Nick Fuentes said he was going to take a black light and see if there were any semen stains on the bed or the sofa that he left behind. I don't know what kind of mind goes there first. That is one strange, twisted kid. Nick Fuentes set my gaydar ringing really, really loud years ago. And so they didn't really get into that stuff, but I think there's a lot of that that's going to be coming out. I think a lot of the people around him were very puzzled by how weird he is sexually. I think the guy is very likely, closeted homosexual. His Catboy Cammy date video, I thought, was extremely revealing in that area. And I'm not going to criticize him for that, but I think it's very, very interesting that he's built a rather rabidly homophobic crew of people around him. Although that seems to be changing. That's one of the interesting things. It seems to be getting gayer and gayer in the America First camp for reasons that we can only imagine. Anyway, so this is interesting stuff. Old Man Yinzer has donated a diamond. Thank you very much. The only unburnt bridge so far is Milo. Well, and various interns and things like that who cower in fear of the guy. Yeah, this is really, really interesting stuff. This is wonderfully rich, compelling drama. Another thing that I thought was really interesting is apparently once they started Cozy TV, Nick's nightly audiences were significantly lower than they were when he was streaming on other platforms. That's no surprise. You'd think that he'd give it time to build back up, right? Convenience is a thing. If Nick's not on YouTube, they're going to be watching, I don't know, they're going to be watching Antifa videos, right? Or tranny videos and things like that if they can't watch Nick. Catboy videos, stuff like that, stuff that will be recommended in their YouTube thing based on their preferences, right? If he's not there, they're going to just watch other stuff on YouTube. That's how it works. These platforms are kind of addictive. Well, apparently, to hide the fact that he didn't take a lot of his audience with him from YouTube and other platforms to Cozy TV, they started simply multiplying the number of actual live stream viewers by two when it would show up at the bottom of the screen. So if there were 2,500 people listening or watching, it would say 5,000. Viewers. That's pretty fraudulent. Other stuff that was coming out is that his much vaunted Christianity is just a pose, that he's contemptuous of people who pray in front of him. That doesn't surprise me. I had Fuentes explainers explain to me, take me aside and say, Greg, this Christ is King stuff, that's just to keep Jews out of his movement, right? Well, it turns out that didn't keep a Jew from a Jewish fraudster, for that matter, from being instrumental in setting up the America First Foundation or Cozy TV. Or it didn't keep Milo out, although he's supposedly Catholic and straight now. You know, there's holy water does wonders, right? So yeah, there's just a lot about him that's extremely fake and probably extremely gay too. And I'm sure we're going to learn a whole lot more about it. So I'm kind of looking forward to the Fuentes drama. And I usually don't like this kind of drama, but this is just absolutely compelling television, folks. So tune in. This is really something. Alexandra wrote in and asked me to reach out to my contacts in Ukraine with the following question. Apparently, people who are trying to send money to friends in Ukraine are being hit by huge bank fees. You know, the bank will take 10% or something. And a country that is having a war and where millions, if not billions of dollars in aid are flowing in, you'd think that the banks would not be taking such a giant cut. And I'm sure Zelensky's friends at the banks are making out like absolute bandits. And basically, she asked me if I could find out any information about this and if there are ways of getting around it. So I reached out to two friends in Ukraine. And here's the thing. I apologize, but I haven't heard back from them. Not a peep. And I don't know why that is. They're not checking their internet. They could be dead. There's a war going on, or they could think that the question isn't as important as the stuff they're dealing with right now. But I just haven't heard back. But I am going to continue inquiring about this because, yeah, you'd think that in a war like that, when people are in great need and people are sending aid privately and the states, that the banks shouldn't be taking giant cuts out of this, basically in a time of great crisis and need. But that seems to be happening. Okay, Scott writes in with $20. It's very generous. Thank you very much. Greg, the moral argument against naturalism said that there's something about our moral experience that transcends survival. You might think it is less tragic when an elderly person is killed than when a young person is killed because the elderly person lived a full life. But on naturalism, why is their death tragic at all? Well, I think we think that it's sad when old people die, especially if they die of accidents or whatever, because we're wired biologically to feel sympathy for others. And we imagine that we're going to die someday. And, you know, it pains us. Yeah, maybe their life is over. Maybe they've had a long life, et cetera, et cetera. But I still think that we feel sad when even old people die or sick people die, because we feel sympathy, because there's a value to life. And I think that the feeling of sympathy that we have about that is, you know, sort of a deep biologically wired way that we feel the value of life. And I do think the pro-life movement has been extremely effective again at making people feel the value of lives that are otherwise invisible, lives that don't even look necessarily human at the very earliest stages. Namely, we don't look necessarily human at the very earliest stages of our life, but they manage to evoke feelings of sympathy. But I think we feel these feelings of sympathy for all human beings, even old ones. But I do think that we feel more for people who have more life ahead of them. I just think that that's true. But anyway, that's a very good question. I appreciate it. Now, Fritz Kreisler writes in, Dr. Johnson, are you aware of Ashley Ray Goldenberg and her work? He sends $5 Canadian. Thank you very much. I know she is Jewish, but she's openly pro-white and JQ aware herself and gets a lot of backlash for being Jewish. What is your opinion of her? She was recently mentioned in the New York Times. The only thing I know about Ashley Ray Goldenberg is that she had the bad taste at one time to date Matt Heimbach. This was apparently a long time ago. But yeah, she and Heimbach were briefly an item, I understand. She goes by Communism Kills. I've seen some of her anti-communist messaging. I thought it was extremely effective. Here's the thing, okay? I'm as JQ-wise as you can reasonably go, which does imply that you can be unreasonably JQ sensitive, okay? And I think it's unreasonably JQ sensitive that when somebody says, oh, by the way, Amy Wax is a Jew, or Libs of TikTok is a Jew, or Communism Kills is a Jew, and immediately the thought is, uh-oh, nothing good can come of this. Maybe they have a Jewish agenda, right? Yet at the same time, people like this have messages that I think to some extent coincide with what we want, messages on race, realism or communism or crazy stuff that transsexuals and people like that who are basically indoctrinating children are saying. I think they have maybe their own agenda. Maybe it ultimately differs from white nationalism. I'm sure it does. However, the work that they do is not useless to us. It's actually helpful to us. And I think it's possible to build on it and to be somewhat grateful for it and somewhat gracious about it and not react with sort of a paranoid waspiness or waspishness whenever it's you learn that, oh my goodness, they happen to be Jewish, right? There can be Jews who are doing good things, useful things, things that objectively help whites. And I think that we should be realistic about that fact and just wish that there were more like them. I've always maintained that there are good Black people. There are good Jews. I just wish there were more of them. Then we would have a different world and whites would be better off. Middle class twit writes in with 12 Great Britain pounds. Thank you very much. Is libertarianism rooted in resentment of paying tax? Yeah, I think part of that is true. But I think there are deeper roots to libertarianism. I was a libertarian before I was paying taxes. I was a libertarian when I was a teenager. And I think it has more to do with not wanting to be told what to do by people who think that they know better than you. That was certainly part of it for me. I felt like I was smarter than a lot of the people who thought that they knew better than I did. And I just wanted the freedom to do my own thing. And I think a lot of it has to do with that. I think the tax thing is something that comes later. And I think that is sort of a petty motive, if you will. And I think that libertarianism's critics, of course, love to paint it in the most petty light. But I think that there are more serious motives for being libertarian. I think there are more serious arguments for being libertarian. I just don't think it's ultimately best political philosophy, because although I do think liberty is an important thing and a good thing in society, there are more important things. And sometimes when liberty conflicts with the more important things have to win out. And for me, that would basically be maintaining the integrity of our community, our nations, and our race. Those things are more important than liberty. But where liberty doesn't conflict with those things, I still like a society that has quite a lot of it. And I think there should be just a prima facie, how to put prejudice in favor of having freedoms, where freedoms don't conflict with the good life. And often they're part of the good life, but they're not necessarily always good. Freedom is a good thing, but it's not necessarily always good. And therefore, you have to have certain laws that traduce freedom for the greater good. Anyway, that's my thinking on it. So thank you for those. Those are all very good questions. Muhammad Aryan writes in with 15 Australian dollars. Greetings, Dr. Johnson. I hope you are doing fine. I have two questions for this session. First, which is your favorite English dialect? Mine is the Ulster one. Well, that's an interesting question. I like two kinds of accents. I think really what you're talking about is accent rather than dialect. There are two kinds of accents that I like. I like accents that are very clearly enunciated and articulated because they just communicate intelligence, right? When people have accents that slur words and don't articulate, don't enunciate, it just sounds stupid, you know, bixnood kind of stupid, you know, that I find offensive to the ear. So the most articulated and clear accents are the ones that sound most intelligent to me. And that would be, for me, English received pronunciation, the sort of upper crust received pronunciation in Great Britain. Whenever somebody speaks that way, I immediately think they have at least 10 IQ points added on. They just sound smarter, right? And when people speak, sort of Black American English, I deduct 10 points just because of the way they sound. But there's another kind of accent that I really like, and that is sort of a musical accent. And I don't know exactly what that connotes or communicates, but it's pleasant. And I do find that Irish English Some of it has a very musical quality to it. Some of it just sounds mumbly. I think of Keith Wood, right, or Woods. He is kind of a mumbly, down-in-the-mouth Irish accent that I find tiresome and unmusical. But there are people with Irish accents that have very musical ways of speaking, and I do think that's quite beautiful. So yeah, I kind of get what you're saying about the Irish accent. If it's musical, I really like it. And I do like very clear, enunciated, articulated, received pronunciation English, as they call it. The sort of posh sound. Now, there's a higher class sound than that. And that's the sound, the accent of the extremely high aristocracy that often just mumble unintelligibly. And they'll start speaking and then they'll just go, it's like, what? So, you know, it's not the highest high class stuff. The highest high class stuff sounds slurred and unintelligible. Oftentimes Peter Brimlow will sort of trail off that way. And it's an extremely aristocratic kind of British accent, actually. But the more received pronunciation that you hear on the best BBC presenters and things like that, that is my favorite, I have to say. I find the American accent, my own accent, can be extremely grating. I don't like listening to myself, especially when I say words like grass or glass. That just grates, you know. I like the British received pronunciation, but it would sound fake if I were to affect that. And Muhammad's other question is, secondly, what's your opinion of Richard Rorty? Why has pragmatism been the dominant strain of philosophy in America? Regards. Well, that's two questions. What's my opinion of Richard Rorty? Richard Rorty was an American philosopher. He's dead now. And when I was in an undergraduate, I was told that his book, Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, was an absolutely crucial book. So I picked it up and I couldn't make heads or tails of it. I just found it baffling. Basically, what Rorty is he's a pragmatist who takes a lot of sort of late linguistic analytic philosophy very, very seriously. I find that philosophy baffling, dumbfounding, and extremely boring. And, he also took John Dewey very seriously. He took Heidegger, interestingly enough, very seriously. And so I found Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature to be an unreadable book. However, when I was off in graduate school, I saw him give a lecture and I found him fascinating. He sort of spoke through these clenched teeth. And he was a strange character with the shock of white hair. And he basically just was the most incredibly smug liberal. And he was speaking to an academic audience. And it was like, we liberals. And that just grated on me because I can't stand that kind of talk. It's like an ultra smug left liberal type. And he was very, very open that his political commitments were absolutely primary, whereas I found that offensive because even though I had some very strong political commitments from the very beginning, I would change them if I thought the arguments were ineffective. This is when I was getting out of libertarianism, when I was being around Rorty. And so the idea of just sort of starting out with political premises and then constructing a philosophy around it, that seemed like a mental trap, the kind of mental trap that I was avoiding successfully. I have to say that his book, Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, was a really good statement of his thinking, but I just don't think it's very valid. I really don't. Yeah, and he was a pragmatist in the tradition of John Dewey, which takes practice to be primary. I like pragmatism. I'm more of a William James guy myself, a C.S. Peirce guy myself. I don't like how pragmatism has just been melded with left liberal progressivism because I don't think that's a very good philosophy. But the great American pragmatist thinkers like Peirce and Dewey, Peirce and James are truly great thinkers. They're among the greatest philosophers of the modern era. And I'm kind of proud as an American that they're my fellow countrymen. Pragmatism is basically post-Kantian philosophy. It takes Kant's critique of metaphysics seriously, but it also then turns towards the primacy of practical reason and then manages to bring back a lot of real metaphysical issues again on different non-dogmatic practical grounds. And this is especially true of the religious philosophy of William James, which I think is very, very convincing. So yeah, Rorty is certainly not the first place to go if you're interested in pragmatism. The first place to go is to pick up William James's essays, The Will to Believe, and Pragmatism. Those are very important starting points. But that's a very good question, so thank you very much. Now, Seeley has written in with $5. I'm going to give you your $5 worth, seriously. Seeley wants to know, what are my reasons for being hopeful about the movement? A few weeks ago, on a couple of occasions, actually, I talked about what I would do if I thought the movement was hopeless, if the cause was hopeless. So what are my reasons to be hopeful? Okay. So basically, I guess I can give six kinds of reasons for why I'm hopeful, aside from the fact that I just seem to be, I wouldn't call it clinical. I'm clinically optimistic. There's just something about me that's biased towards optimism, but I don't think it's an unreasonable optimism, right? I've analyzed my optimism, and I think I've come up with good reasons for it. And I've been a little extra skeptical because I know I have a bias in favor of the optimistic outcome. So these are the reasons why I'm optimistic. First of all, reality is on our side. We have a true worldview about human biology, about what makes a good society. And because we have the truth about that, because nationalism is true, because biology matters, because kinship matters, because culture matters, and therefore nationalism, not globalism, not imperialism, not one size fits all, universalism is the best political philosophy for all peoples, we have better consequences. We can produce more reliably the goods of political life. We are the ones who are most capable of producing prosperity and security and peace and preserving the interesting differences between peoples that are at the heart of who we are. So we've got reality on our side, and that makes it possible for us to deliver the goods. Okay, that's reason one. Reason two is that our enemies don't have reality on their side, and therefore, the more that they act upon their principles, the more bad consequences are going to happen. And as more and more bad consequences happen, more and more people will push back against them. And it's going to be get easier and easier for us to make the case that we have the solution, because obviously they don't. And it's all well and good to say we've got the best theory, but when we can show that not only do we have the best theory, but that the opposite theory is producing terrible consequences, whereas we can point to examples of our ideas producing good consequences, that's very convincing. Okay, so that really brings us to another point, which is not only do we have reality on our side, but we've got the best arguments. We've got the best theories. Okay. I guess we can say that having the best arguments and having the best theories is the same thing as having reality on our side. We have a true account of politics. So yet another factor is that we've got the best people. Now, this might sound very odd given for instance, the recent Nick Fuentes news, right? We do have the best people. We have some of the worst people attracted to nationalism. There's no question about that. But that's true of every political movement, especially every dissident political movement. Bad people, marginal people, grifters, kooky people will be attracted to dissident ideas. But I've met the best people that I know in this movement as well. And we have an amazing number of extremely high quality people. And I'm seeing growth in the numbers of very high quality people. And that's another reason I'm one of these people who is on the inside of the movement looking out. I'm on the inside of the movement looking out. I have this platform and I can see the growth. I can look at the stats. I can see the growth. Frode Midyord polled some of the people who follow his Telegram channel a year or so ago. And the question he asked was, when did they start following our movement? And I forget what the number was, but it was significant, like 25 to 40% said that they had started following our movement only since 2018. That means that for those people, the alt-right wasn't ancient history, it was prehistory. These people came in after the alt-right had basically collapsed, right? These people are very new. The large numbers of new people are coming in. They're being driven to us by the bad consequences of globalization and multiculturalism. We're getting new people all the time, and we're getting better and better quality people all the time. And that positive growth is very apparent from where I'm sitting. It might not be apparent to people out in the audience, because people out in the audience see the stage, they see the movement, they see the content creators, and they see people getting picked off by deplatforming or burnout or drama, stuff like that. And they see that some of their favorite people are gone, have quit. And they think that because the stage is emptying out, that the movement is shrinking. But the movement is you people out there in the dark, right? Not the people up on stage. It's the people out there listening, and that movement is growing. And then another reason I'm optimistic is that there are many examples from the past of white people triumphing over great odds. I think of the Spanish people. The Spanish people were occupied by Islam for centuries, and they regained control of their country. The Irish were occupied by the English for centuries, and they regained control of their country. The Poles lost control of their country for hundreds of years and regained control of it. It is possible for peoples to be conquered and denied independence, denied their own homelands, but to preserve their identity, preserve their distinctness, and regain control of their destiny by gaining control of their homelands. And so if it's possible for the Poles and the Hungarians and a lot of other white peoples who have suffered for very long periods of time under foreign domination, the Russians under the Mongol yoke, the Spanish under the Moors, etc., the people of the Balkans under the Turks, then it's possible for us. They're not fundamentally different from us. They are us. So if we've done it before, we can do it again. So those are all reasons why I'm fundamentally pretty optimistic about the chances of nationalism for all white nations reversing white genocide, regaining control of our destinies in our various homelands. Okay, Friedrich writes in, "Hi, Greg, do you have any thoughts on the debate between Adam Green and E. Michael Jones and Christianity? If you've watched it, I mean. If not, do you think it would be possible to somehow solve this divisive issue in the dissident right? All the best." And he sends in $21. That's very generous. I'm sorry I haven't watched the debate. I think it's a divisive issue, but I think it's an issue that we can deal with. We can square that particular circle because for me, at least, whether you're Christian or pagan or atheist or a Buddhist for that matter, as long as you're a white person who is fighting against white genocide, you're part of this cause. And I just think that that's how we have to look at it. We have to be basically tolerant of religious differences because religious differences are not essential to the fight that we're in. There are many people who say, no, you can only win against white genocide if you become Orthodox Christians. Other people will say you can only do it if you worship Odin or take psilocybin mushrooms or whatever. I don't buy those prerequisite arguments, right? Some kind of religious prerequisites have to be put in place before you can look at the world in front of you and take your own side in a fight. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. There's certainly some moral prerequisites that need to be put in place. And sometimes religious doctrines can get in the way of taking your own side, definitely. But I think that we can sort of set aside these issues for the sake of unity. There are other questions that are essential and that we need to fight out. We need to just come to some kind of solution on. But I don't think this is an essential question. So that's my basic thinking on the matter. I want to be somewhat tolerant of one another's religious differences because I don't think that these add-on issues about religion are essential to what we're trying to do.
Archie Bunker
raised a couple good questions over at Odyssey. What's going on in countries like Japan, Korea, and China, which are very advanced societies where fertility has dropped immensely, and it hasn't been engineered by the suspects that we have in the West, right? What's going on here? Is there a hostile genocidal elite in charge of Korea? No, I wouldn't say so. There are a couple factors here. First of all, we shouldn't discount the influence of Western ideas and Western elites on countries like South Korea or Japan. They've clearly been massively influenced, including bad ideas, antinatalist ideas. Every 6 months, the New York Times has some journalist writing an article about how the Japanese finally need to become multicultural. They're not ignored, unfortunately. So the hostile elite in the West is hostile to Japan and China and South Korea too. And they do press their ideas. They put their ideas out there. And I think we'd be foolish to discount their influence. But there's another factor that's much larger here. And that's simply that even without a hostile elite, there are certain traits of advanced, modern, industrial consumer society that are deadly to reproduction, that are deadly to fertility. And even if we didn't have the particular hostile elite in the West that's leveraging our decline and egging it on, pushing it forward with open borders and race replacement immigration, we would still have to deal with the ethos of modern urban society, which suppresses fertility. The biggest factor, globally speaking, that suppresses fertility is urbanization. And it doesn't matter what kind of society you live in. You can live in the Islamic Republic of Iran and urbanized life drives down fertility. You can live in Japan and urbanized life drives down fertility. You can live in Nigeria and urban life in Nigeria will drive your fertility down. So there are certain features of modernity as such that I think have to be addressed if we're going to have advanced industrial societies and not have collapsing populations. And eventually these will have to be addressed. It's one of the things that we have to address if advanced civilizations, East and West, are not going to perish. So I think these are good questions. If you wish to look on the front page of Countercurrents and scroll down sort of on the right side of the screen to the sponsored links, you will see our friends Alaska Chaga there. Go there and click that link and buy their products. They're sponsors at Countercurrents and they're very, very generous donors here on the live stream. So thank you very much. Yeah, urbanization does kill fertility. You know, abortion, contraception, yes, all of these are factors that drive fertility down. But even if we had no abortion, there would still be an effect from urbanization. It's very, very interesting. Oh, Friedrich Richter writes in, please write to me if you want to do a translation. And I'd love to hear from you. Just write to me at editor@countercurrents.com, counter-currents.com. If you don't put the hyphen in, it ends up at some Marxist publication in India, which I didn't even know existed when I set up Countercurrents. Anyway, I occasionally get articles by South Asian Marxists or people who want to publish on their platform, they send it to the wrong countercurrents. And one time our webpage editor got one of these things and read it and thought, you know, it's not exactly in line with our thinking, but you know, it's still valid. And so he published it. And this poor guy realized the horror that his article that he thought was going to the South Asian Marxist publication ended up at Countercurrents. And he wrote in hat in hand, begging us to take down his article, which we did. So who knows, maybe occasional white nationalist articles sneak out on the other Countercurrents site. I don't know. But I thought that was a good story. It just shows the horseshoe effect is sometimes real, right? Eric has written in. Eric is one of my frequent correspondents. He sends me many useful book recommendations and article recommendations and questions. So he's asked me three questions that I will run through here. And then we'll wrap up unless more questions come in, right? So he says, what are your favorite museums and art galleries? Okay, well, you asked for it. I'm a big museum lover, I have to admit. I haven't gone to all the great museums yet, but whenever I go to a city that has a great museum, that's the first thing I go to. In the United States, my favorite museums are the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and also the Frick Collection in New York is a superb, smaller museum that has some extremely good old master paintings in it. I also like the Rurik Museum in New York City, which has a lot of Nicholas Rurik's paintings. I'm very fond of him. And I like the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. That's a pretty amazing collection of old masters. And both the National Gallery and the Met also have a lot of great American art, as you would expect. And great American art is great art in European traditions. And I'm a big fan of America, the European civilization, the offshoot of European civilization on the North American continent. So those are great places to go to get in touch with America's roots. In London, the National Gallery is one of the great treasure houses of painting. I like the Tate Britain Gallery. That's a great museum. And the British Museum is very, very important. And I'll give you a couple more. In Paris, you got to see the Louvre, but you also should see the Musée Gustave Moreau. It's a museum dedicated to a single painter. And it's an amazing collection of paintings and drawings and works in all stages of completion. So it gives you a sense of this man's creative process. In Germany, one of my favorite museums is the Villa Stuck, which is another single artist museum. It's in Munich. It's Franz von Stuck's gallery, or his villa and his studio, and it has a number of his works in it. So those are a few. I don't want to bore you with long lists, but those are some of my favorites, places that I want to return to, places that I could return to again and again for years. And Eric also asks, what are some of the greatest engineering achievements of Western man? Well, I'm just going to give one. I think this is the greatest engineering achievement, sending man to space. Finally, he asks for some of my favorite epic films. Well, some of you might guess Lawrence of Arabia. That is my favorite epic film. I also like Dr. Zhivago, also by David Lean. I like El Cid. I think that's a fantastic epic film from the early 1960s. I like Ben-Hur. I think that's a great epic set in the ancient world. And I love the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings trilogy. So those are some epics that I highly recommend. Okay, folks, well, that seems to be it. That wraps it up. So thank you very much for tuning in. I enjoy the AMAs. I enjoy the interviews, and I like doing one of each in the average stream. So we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio, guest to be determined. But if you can't get enough Countercurrents tomorrow, tune in for the Writer's Block with Nick Gilvey. Nick Gilvey will be back on the Writer's Block. His guest is Riley Wagaman, who will be talking about the situation in Russia today. It's a Russia insider's look from a guy who's actually inside Russia rather than some guy in Pennsylvania. That will be at the regular time, which is 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and 10 p.m. Central European time. So please join Nick Gilvey tomorrow for the Writer's Block. And I'm looking forward to another episode next week of Countercurrents Radio. Thanks for the listeners. Thanks for the donors. Thanks for the moderators. And we will be back.